Thank you. Be seated. In the cause of Shumate v. Fogle, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. And the court is now ready to hear argument from petitioners.
May it please the court, Ms. Denise Smith is now ready for petitioners. I expect that we reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. Your Honors, my name is Denise Smith. And together with my co-counsel, Mr. Ken Link, we represent the petitioner in this case, Ms. Janet Shumate, individually and as the administratrix of the estate of her deceased daughter, Miranda Gilley. This was a lawsuit below against Fogle Limited and others, which are an apartment complex and owners and managers of an apartment complex, arising out of a baby drowning case. The issue this court to resolve today is whether in a child survival action, a defendant will be entitled to contribution for damages to the child's estate from the parent who is negligent in the child's supervision. And of course, the petitioner is hoping that the answer that this court will give to that question will be no, for two reasons. And I'll have 2 points for these reasons, Your Honors. If the Court of Appeals opinion is allowed to stand, parental or familial immunity will be completely abolished. And for the second reason, that the law of contribution would be placed on its head, and third-party defendants could be liable to direct defendants when those third-party defendants couldn't be sued by the plaintiff themselves.
Would you repeat your three reasons again?
I beg your pardon, Your
Honor. Would you repeat your three reasons the answer should be no?
I beg your pardon, Your Honor. There are two reasons.
Oh, okay.
The first is that parental or familial immunity would be completely abolished if the Court of Appeals opinion were allowed to stand. And the second is that the law of contribution would be placed on its head because third-party defendants would be allowed to recover and would be liable, to direct defendants when those third-party defendants couldn't be sued by the plaintiff. Your Honors, before I turn to my first point, I'd like to give the Court a few facts, because these facts are very critical, because it's in the context of these facts that the Court of Appeals held that the Fogle respondents were allowed contribution.
Were these taken from the pleadings?
Yes, Your Honor, they are.
And that would be the only source of them, I take it, in this case.
That's correct, Your Honor, and that's from the plaintiff's seventh amended petition in the transcript of page 128.
So all we know about the facts of this case are from the record is what the plaintiffs allege.
Not only that, Your Honor, but also what is in the Court of Appeals opinion, because in respondents' brief, they do not quarrel with the Court of Appeals opinion, and in their brief say that the facts of the case are pretty much as stated by the Court of Appeals opinion.
So the Court of Appeals made some up outside the record, and nobody quarrels with that, and we could look at that.
Well, technically, I guess that would be correct, Your Honor, but I certainly don't mean to imply that. The facts of this case are extremely critical because this is a negligent supervision case. This is not the cases that this court has looked at before. This is not a parent driving a car and the child has had an accident. This is not a parent who's an employer. This was a parent who was acting as a parent and doing activities that were essentially parental activities. Janet Shumate was vacuuming her house, and her child slipped out of the house, and Miranda Gilley, the child, was 23 months old. Somehow she slipped out the back, found herself in the pool, and Ms. Shumate began to look for her child. The child was found in the bottom of the apartment complex swimming pool. Mrs. Shumate, forgetting that she couldn't swim, jumped into the pool to save her daughter. Other people in the apartment complex also joined in the assistance and had to save both Janet Shumate and her daughter as well from the pool. Paramedics came on the scene, resuscitated the child, and in fact the child lived for a period of time. The child was semi-comatose for 121 days at Fort Worth Cook's Children's Hospital, Eventually, the child was taken to a nursing home because nothing more could be done for it, and the child died.
This is all in the petition?
Yes, Your Honor. It is.
It troubles me a bit that we don't know whether the evidence of trial established this or some completely different case. Why you say, you begin by saying the facts are extremely critical. Why isn't that a significant impediment in this case?
Would you repeat your question, Your Honor? I'm not sure I understand your question.
You say the facts are extremely critical, but the facts aren't in this case. All we have to indicate what this case is about is the petition. Why doesn't that impede our reaching the issue that you say is important in the case regarding contribution of parental unity?
Well, Your Honor, if there were any quarrel between the parties on any of the facts, that would become a problem because this is a limited appeal. And as this court knows, only the transcript was brought up and not the statement of facts. However, the parties are not quarreling over the facts. And in fact, as the respondents have said in their brief, that they do not quarrel with the facts as the Court of Appeals has stated them. And so I wouldn't think that would be a problem for this court since essentially there's almost been a stipulation, if you will, by the parties or a judicial admission of those basic facts. The importance of these facts are, Your Honors, that what, and let me back up a moment and say that the jury made findings as to the apartment complex defendant and as to Ms. Shoemake because her conduct was also examined. The jury found among all the apartment complex defendants that they were 55% negligent. That is because there was negligence as a matter of law because the fence around the pool, there were some problems with the fence and it didn't comply with the Arlington standards. The importance is that the jury found that Mrs. Shoemake was 45% negligent as well. What their finding was that she was 45% negligent in her supervision of her child. Not that she was 45% negligent as the driver of a car or any non-parental function, but those were the basic facts. The facts were that the child slipped out of her house. And therefore, that's very important for this court to focus on because if this court allows the Court of Appeals' opinion to stand, parental or familial immunity would be completely abolished because what it would allow these parties to do is to recover against a mother when a child herself could not recover against a mother. As this court knows, there are two exceptions that are carved out where a tort is unintentional. And turning to the first point, and that is that parental or familial immunity will be completely abolished. The first exception that this court carved out was in Felderhoff versus Felderhoff back in 1971 when it said that an employer, that a child could recover against its parent who was an employer and that the bar of parental immunity didn't apply. This court again looked at that in Farley versus M&M Cattle Company and said basically the same thing, that where the parent is not acting like a parent, isn't supervising the child, isn't having parental type functions, and there's not some unique parent-child relationship, that the bar would be lifted. Most recently, this court wrote on this topic in Jelani versus Jelani, in which the driver of an automobile was a parent, and the child was allowed to recover against that parent because the parent was the driver of an automobile. And this court was very specific and made sure that it carved out this exception only upon the facts of that case and was very careful to do that and reiterated its Felderhoff holdings that when you're looking at the unique relationship between a parent and child, that the court does not want to get involved in that, that the court doesn't want to police that kind of activity. As a matter of fact, in the Jelani opinion, this court cited with approval the case of Snyder versus Coe out of Delaware that said that unlike driving a car, the supervision of one's child involves issues of parental control, authority, discretion, and that this court doesn't want to interfere with that sort of thing.
If this lady had been rendering daycare for some of the neighbors and had some other little children there along with her own, and one of them had slipped out and drowned in the pool, no doubt she would have been negligent. No doubt she could have been found liable for that negligence.
I would say probably so, Your Honor.
What's the difference between that child and her child?
Well, that child, she is the employee of a daycare center, and she has been entrusted with a special obligation. And while we might believe that she's been, that Mrs. Shoemake has been entrusted by our Creator with a special obligation, that obligation is between her and her children and her family and her Creator.
Even if it's the same as the same supervision and the same care that she's rendering to the another little child that sit right beside her own. Two of them sit right there together. One of them's hers and one of them's not. If hers drowns, the child cannot recover. If the other little child does, then the child can't.
I would say so, Your Honor. And I understand that that's a uniquely difficult position, but I think it comes out of the fundamental fabric of our society where we just don't want to be policing the activity. We don't want to get into a household and tell them how to run a household. And possibly that's a discussion.
Tell them how to drive a car, but not to keep kids away from food.
I would say so, Your Honor, because that would be supervision and control unique within the family. And in Page versus Bing, which is a case I've cited in my brief to the court, a 2.5-year-old child fell in a manhole, and the court said, in Michigan, pointed out that there, it's a practical impossibility to look at these cases on a case-by-case basis, and further on went on to talk about how it's just really impossible to have one standard imposed into another family. It's difficult for a person to go into another family and say, okay, the standard will be this, because each family is unique. And in fact, that's kind of what makes us all different and a part of our melting pot type society, that we don't tell one another how to raise our families. In fact, the Supreme Court of the United States found that so important that in Wisconsin versus Yoder, it decided that it would not get involved in the education of a child as long as that child was being educated, that it would allow the family to educate its children however it wished, as long as that child was being educated.
We've already decided to get somewhat involved in Summer Home in July, and the question really left is how much. Isn't that right?
Certainly, Your Honor.
You say that the line should be drawn on the other side of this case.
Certainly, Your Honor. I would say that.
If the doctrine of parental immunity were abolished, there would be no impediment to doing what the Court of Appeals did here, would there?
That's exactly correct, Your Honor. In fact, if this court decides against me on my first point, then I do lose my second point. Because
but the doctrine of parental immunity remains intact, subject to the exceptions set out in Jelani and Felderhoff, then we have a problem.
Yeah, that's precisely so, Your Honor.
It's not unique in the law that we allow some people to sue and not others. An employer cannot be sued by an employee because of workers' comp, but that employer is not free from liability for negligence to the whole world because of the same act.
That's correct.
Third party may be able to come in and sue the employer if they've been successfully sued by the employee, if there's a contractual relationship between the third party and the employer.
Right.
So what the Court of Appeals did does not necessarily destroy the doctrine of parental immunity as between the parent and the child. That's still a call for this court to make. You know, what you're saying is it may allow recovery in one area and not allow the recovery by somebody else, that is the child, for the identical conduct.
Well, yes, Your Honor, and the problem with that, of course, is that you're giving a cause of action to the direct defendant against a third party, and that plaintiff itself would not be able to sue that third party, and that's
the problem. That is not something that is foreign to the law. That has been done in other places in our law.
Well, this court didn't allow that sort of thing in the Varela case in 1983, and specifically in the comp arena, this court didn't allow that in the Magro case in 1986.
That's right, but we do allow it if there's some type of contractual relationship between.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
We don't allow it on a common law basis.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. And in the arena of the comparative negligence statute, I would point something out to the court that I think is very important, and that is that This case happened in 1986, and so we're under old 2212A, which later became 3301. And specifically in the comparative negligence statute, when they were passing House Bill 88, the 63rd legislature talked about family immunity within the context of the statute. Now, it's not carried forward into the remedies code because it's put into another place in the book. But specifically, at page 42 of the session laws, section 3, Your Honor, I see that my time has expired.
Finish your sentence.
Thank you. At section 3, it specifically says that nothing in this act affects any judicially developed and developing rule under which a person is or is not totally or partially immune from tort liability to another by virtue of a family relationship. And so basically what I'm saying, Your Honors, is the legislature was quite aware of parental and familial immunity type things and that there was a bar to that. And when it passed 2212A, the contribution statute that this court has to focus on today, in that context, it wanted to allow this court and the common law to set the parental immunity bar and did not wish to abrogate that. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Michael Northrup, to present argument from respondents.
May it please the court, my name is Mike Northrup, and I represent the respondents in this appeal. Essentially, there are two issues involved in this appeal, and the first is whether the doctrine of parental immunity will apply to the facts of this appeal. The second issue is whether the petitioners are entitled to rely upon the doctrine of parental immunity in spite of the fact that the petitioners did not plead parental immunity in the trial court as an affirmative defense. Before I address those issues, however, I want to address some facts that have been brought out before this court. Specifically, the chart that is before the court, this is the petitioner's chart. I want to correct a few things with regard to that chart. There's some inaccuracies in it. I think the Court of Appeals opinion accurately reflects the status of the pleadings and the causes of action that were brought against the various parties here. Essentially, with regard to the 45% contribution here in the first column, that wasn't really contribution. That was an affirmative, the 45% reduction there was a reduction for our affirmative defense that we raised with regard to the contributory negligence of Janet Shoemake in causing damages to her own wrongful death cause of action. There was only one counterclaim that was brought by the defendants in this case. And that was a counterclaim brought not against the estate of Miranda, as this chart would allege. It was a counterclaim brought against Janet Shoemake for her negligence in causing damages to the estate of Miranda Gilley. We sought an offset or essentially a credit for contribution from Janet Shoemake for those damages, and that would be a 45% credit from the $66,000 that was awarded to the estate of Miranda, or approximately $29,851. With regard to the figure that's up next to the 45% contribution, that is not the 45%. That's actually the 55% that Janet Shoemake was awarded, and the difference there is the 45% contribution that was offset.
Counsel, for your client to prevail, don't we have to either abolish the doctrine of parental immunity under these circumstances completely in the, for negligent supervision of the mother of the child, or overrule those cases that say that the right to contribution is derivative of the plaintiff's right to sue that third-party defendant?
No, Justice Cornyn. Actually, under existing Texas law, the defendants are entitled to contribution from Janet Shoemake, and the estate of Miranda Gilley is entitled to bring a direct action against Janet Shoemake. Certainly, with regard to the questions that Justice Heck brought up, this record does not demonstrate whether this was a supervisory function, and part of the reason it doesn't demonstrate that is the record that was brought forward to this court didn't bring forth any of the supervisory functions because we never had any idea that they were intending to rely upon the doctrine of parental immunity as a defense to this cause of action. But specifically addressing the question whether the court needs to abolish the doctrine of parental immunity, we do not think that the court would have to go that far. It's our position that the current state of Texas law would permit a cause of action against Janet Shoemake for the damages of Miranda Gilley. The reason being that the state of Texas has recognized three important exceptions to the doctrine of parental immunity, all essentially slowly, narrowly tailoring the doctrine to the purpose for which it was intended, that is to protect the family unit and family harmony. The Felderhoff case is a business exception case, and essentially the court in that case stated that in instances where the doctrine does not promote the purposes for which it was intended, it should not be applied. Consequently, because that occurred in the context of a business relationship, even though the defendant was the father of the claimant, the court recognized an exception. The second exception that has been recognized in the state of Texas was recognized in the case of Sneed versus Sneed. That's the case that the Court of Appeals was relying upon in its opinion. And I think the petitioners have mischaracterized the opinion to the extent that they characterize it as entirely abolishing parental immunity. I don't think it's doing that. I think the Court of Appeals holding is essentially that when you have a wrongful death cause of action or a death situation, there is no family harmony or family relationship left to promote. No duties owed by the parent to the child in that relationship any further, and consequently it doesn't make any sense to apply the doctrine of parental immunity in that situation.
If the child remained comatose and not died, would that change the...
I think it would, Justice Cornyn, and certainly those are not the facts that are before us in this case.
What relationship is there to preserve if the child is in a vegetative state?
I think there has to be some relationship. Otherwise, this court wouldn't have decided Reagan versus Vaughn as it did recently in finding that there can be a cause of action for loss of consortium in a non-death case, even where there's a comatose patient. So I think there still has to be some sort of a relationship there and a loss of it. I don't know that I can fully answer your question in terms of how to characterize that, but I think it would be fair to say there is the parent would still legally owe certain duties to care for that child, so there would be a family relationship that the courts should protect, and we believe that the doctrine still has some importance with regard to the family unit. The third exception that was recognized, of course, is one that the petitioners have pointed out, Jelani versus Jelani, where the court found that it was essentially unnecessary in that instance to apply the doctrine of parental immunity because the accident occurred in the course of a parent driving an automobile and did not occur in the course of the supervisory functions of the parent. With regard to our second issue in this appeal, and that is the waiver point. This court, should it find that the doctrine of parental immunity does apply, there's an additional reason not to find in favor of the petitioners, because the petitioners did not at any point plead the doctrine of parental immunity as an affirmative defense. And as this court held in 1987 in the case of Davis versus City of San Antonio, the failure to plead an immunity constitutes a waiver of the immunity defense. And that's exactly what occurred here. All three defendants in the trial court separately pled the right to contribution from Janet Shoemake towards any damages that were found to have been sustained by the estate of Miranda Gilley. And in response to that, there was no affirmative defense of parental immunity pled. In fact, if you'll look at the petitioner's post-submission brief filed in the Court of Appeals, you will see that they admitted that they did not plead parental immunity as an affirmative defense. They attempted to explain in that brief their failure to plead the doctrine of parental immunity as an affirmative defense, and frankly, I'm a little surprised at the explanation. The explanation was that they were unaware or that they didn't have notice of the nature of the claims that were being brought by the defense. Now, of course, the petitioners never filed a Rule 90 special exception to require pleading with further specificity, but in addition to that, if you look at the pleadings are very specific, and I'll read you Fogle Limited's pleading in its fifth amended original answer. Specifically, that pleading provides that by way of counterclaim, the negligence of Janet Shoemake would entitle Defendant Fogle Limited to contribution from Janet Shoemake in connection with the cause of action of and damages to the estate of Miranda Gilley. The other two defendants filed counterclaims that were very similarly worded. Those were three separate pleadings that this record demonstrates where the right to contribution was pled, and never was the doctrine of parental immunity affirmatively asserted. A fourth pleading is found in this record, the motion to amend judgment subsequent to entry of judgment, in which we again asserted our right to contribution in the trial court, and there was no defense of parental immunity raised, and there was no attempt to amend the plaintiff's pleadings to assert the defense of parental immunity. A fourth and fifth pleading are also found in this record. The notice of limitation of appeal, in which we were beginning to perfect our appeal, and we stated what the issue was going to be on appeal. Also, notice of record of limitation of appeal. In each of those instances, we stated that we were entitled to contribution from Janet Shoemake towards the damages of the estate. And the first time you have mention of parental immunity is in the appellee's brief in the Court of Appeals, in which we were accused of laying behind the log in terms of what exactly we wanted, in spite of the fact that the record demonstrates that on six separate occasions, we raised the right to contribution, and consequently the failure of them to assert this affirmative defense is a waiver under this court's opinion in Davis versus City of San Antonio. So it is essentially it is for those reasons that the respondents are entitled to prevail in this appeal. To address Ms. Smith's arguments with regard to the abolition of contribution rules, I don't think that the Court of Appeals opinion goes quite that far. I think the Court of Appeals opinion essentially, in fact, I'll read the relevant portion. I think they're essentially relying and incorporating the case of Sneed versus Sneed in their opinion, but specifically they hold that we hold that the parental immunity doctrine has no application to the facts before us. Specifically, we hold that the doctrine of parental immunity does not apply when a deceased child's estate recovers damages against a defendant in a survival action and the defendant seeks contribution from the parent. The important language there is that you have a deceased child and the estate of the child. And I think if you look to Sneed versus Sneed, in which the second exception I mentioned was created for a death situation for parental immunity, I think that's exactly what that's getting towards. I don't think this court has to go so far as to abolish contribution rules, and I don't think that's been our position, although that position is supported in some respect in the law, and there are a couple of states which have adopted that very position. But this court...
The rights of contribution are derivative.
Yes, Justice Mazzi. This court, however, doesn't need to go that far in this particular case, and it's our position that under current Texas law that the estate of Miranda Gilley could have brought a direct action against Janet Shoemake, just as we can bring our indirect claim or derivative claim for contribution against Janet Shoemake.
But if they had no standing to bring in under the doctrine of parental immunity and parental supervision, and you go out with them, don't you?
If they had no standing, but in fact, under existing Texas law, they do have standing.
For negligent supervision of a parent?
Well, Justice Mazzi, the record doesn't really demonstrate that this was a question of supervision. In fact, the record perhaps could have been much more complete with regard to that had we known from the pleadings and from an asserted affirmative defense that was going to be the defense relied upon by Ms. Shoemake.
But you're the one that limited the record.
We limited the record, but it was unknown to us at the time in the trial court or in taking an appeal in this case that the immunity was even going to be an issue. The first time we heard about it was in the appellee's brief. And certainly the jury findings that were requested and obtained dealt with the negligence of Janet Shoemake and not negligent supervision of Janet Shoemake.
But you did recognize that the doctrine of parental immunity does have this parental supervision element to it, didn't you?
Yes, Justice Mazzi, I think it would be hard to say not. But as this court said in City Davis versus City of San Antonio, I think there was no surprise in that case that governmental immunity would be an issue. Nevertheless, the court held that the failure to plead the governmental immunity constitutes a waiver of that immunity. Likewise, I think with regard to spousal immunity in Stafford versus Stafford, this court held
the waiver of that immunity is different. The Tort Claims Act is a statutory waiver. Common law immunity.
That's correct, Justice Monty.
It's total common law immunity for which there has been no statutory waiver.
That's correct, but this court in Stafford versus Stafford, in dealing with a question of whether spousal immunity has to be pled as an affirmative defense prior to the abrogation of spousal immunity, of course, held that it is an affirmative defense. It was a common law defense as well, and the court held that it had to be affirmatively pled just as any other immunity.
Just so I understand your argument, it's really based solely on Snead versus Fine. You're not...
Snead versus Snead. Yes, Chief Justice Phillips.
Snead versus whatever. You're not making any argument that any Felderhoff or Jelani doctrines...
Not specifically. To the extent that those doctrines or those cases recognize exceptions where family immunity is not really promoted or preserved...
But you're not thinking of another exception here.
No, no.
It's purely in the case that the parental... situation was ended by death.
That's correct.
But if there were not a Snead case, this would have to be it to sustain your position.
If there were not a Snead case, this would have to be the case of first impression, I guess, for death cases. So with that in mind...
This is the majority rule, as best you can tell it, around the nation.
With regard to...
Death terminates...
Death terminates. It's interesting because there have been not many states that have addressed that. Essentially, as far as I can tell, with regard to the current status of parental immunity across the United States, after, I guess it was adopted in Hewlett versus George, it was almost universally adopted. And then along about the 1960s or 70s, they began to abrogate it and limit it. So to the point that we're at today, where only 35 states still recognize parental immunity, and the vast majority of those 35 states have limited it extensively to supervisory powers or supervisory type functions. With regard to specifically wrongful death or death cases, I think there's only one that I was able to specifically, address that and held that there was no parental immunity, and I think
it's... The Court of Appeals opens its opinion by saying, in this case of first impression, the issue before us is whether the doctrine of parental immunity prohibits a third party from seeking contribution from a negligent parent in a survival action by the child's estate.
That's correct, Justice Mazzi. Actually, the reason this is a case of first impression, I guess, is because it is kind of an indirect action. In Snead versus Snead, that involved a direct action against the parent. So I guess to that extent, this case is postured a little bit differently than Snead. Also, Snead involved a wrongful death case and did not involve a survival action as this one does.
If there are no reason I asked my question was page 4 of the petitioner's brief cites cases from Illinois, Missouri.
I believe most of those cases deal with whether you are entitled to contribution from whether a third party is entitled to contribution from a parent and are not necessarily limited to a wrongful death situation. If I'm not mistaken.
Real.
If there are no
question
further
of parental supervision and negligence, when the jury found the petitioner negligent here, wasn't that a finding of negligent parental supervision?
No, Justice Mazzi, we have no idea whether she was exercising parental supervision at the time of the drowning of Miranda Gilley. In fact, we have no idea what the mother was doing because the record wasn't fully developed in terms of the supervisory issues.
Well, what other kind of negligence could there be in this case? She wasn't driving the car. She didn't electrocute the child with a vacuum cleaner cord. Her negligence, obviously on the face of it, would have to be a failure to exercise proper parental supervision.
Your guess is as good as mine, I guess, based upon the record that is before the court.
How much guessing to it? What else could there be?
Justice Gamage, I'm really not sure that we can definitely say that she was supervising the child whatsoever. In fact, I think there may have been some evidence in the trial court, although I hesitate to bring it up since we don't have the record. I think there may have been some evidence that in fact she was not supervising the child, period. But with regard to that, you know, I really can't speak to that since it's not even in the record. But if there are no further questions,
was framed in traditional classical negligence terms.
I'm sorry. What's
the issue? Was framed in classical negligence terms, was it not?
Yes, it was, Justice Mosley.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Your Honors, I have 3 points on the rebuttal. And my first point is that as to the waiver issue, I can't tell the court how many times my worthy opponent said the word never. And he said that we have never pled immunity as a defense. If this court will look in the transcript at page 70, and the transcript again at page 75, and if it will look again at the transcript at page 103, it will find 3 defensive pleadings by Mrs. Shoemake. She pleads a general denial, she sets up affirmative defenses, and her last affirmative defense before her prayer is that they are not entitled to recover as a matter of law. Now, I'll admit to the court that that's pretty broad, and that's broad enough to drive a bus through, if you will, Your Honors. But the fact of the matter is they didn't specially accept to that. And so we have defended by saying that they are not entitled to recover contribution and indemnity as a matter of law. Now, if they want...
That suggests...
I beg your pardon, Your Honor?
That suggests that if a defendant pleads that the plaintiffs are not entitled to recover as a matter of law, he's pled all the affirmative defenses the rule allows.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't believe I understand your question.
Does that suggest that if a defendant pleads, quote, the plaintiff is not entitled to recover as a matter of law, end of quote, that the defendant has pled all of the affirmative defenses that the rule allows?
Certainly not. I wouldn't say that.
What's the difference?
Well, the difference is that we said that they were not entitled to recover as a matter of law, and we were saying that there was some law, there was a... common law or some kind of legislative enactment that prevented them from recovering. And as
Is the defendant doing the same thing? If say that you're not entitled to recover as a matter of law, aren't affirmative defenses required to be pledged with some degree of specificity to put the other side on notice as to what that affirmative defense will be? Or do they have to run out and address every potential affirmative defense that's out there?
Well, Your Honor, they have to specially accept under Rule 90, as my learned opponent pointed out to the court. And if they don't specially accept, then they have waived it. And the case law is pretty clear there, that if you have a problem with somebody's pleading and it's really broad, whether it's the plaintiff or the defendant or who it happens to be, they have to come in and specially accept. And they've pointed that out to this court, and I agree with that. And unfortunately, I believe that they're tilting at windmills and addressing issues that came up in oral argument at the Court of Appeals that really don't have anything to do with this. Because the fact of the matter is that they pled that they were entitled to contribution and indemnity, and we counterclaimed, and they counterclaimed, and we defended and set up the affirmative defense that they were not entitled as a matter of law. My second point before this court is the issue of death, and whether death is some kind of new exception that courts should make, saying that if there's a death in the family, perhaps we shouldn't have the bar of parental immunity. Your Honors, I believe that it is very simplistic for a court to say, or for anybody to say, that once there's a death in the family, that the relationship is destroyed. I don't believe that really happens.
So if Sneed, does that mean that Sneed is wrongly decided?
Well, Your Honors, I'd like to point out that Sneed has unique facts, and Justice Kadena pointed that out specifically and wanted to confine his opinion to his facts. In the Sneed case, it was different because the entire family died except for the one person. So that family was destroyed.
So it's a kind of a, if you lose everybody, then you could have an exception.
Well, quite frankly, I disagree with the Sneed court on that particular issue.
So
but
your,
that
your
is...
Sneed is wrong, so that's your...
Well, I believe, I wouldn't say that Sneed is wrong, Your Honor, because I believe that this court might reach the same conclusion as Sneed because of the fact that the father was piloting an airplane. And this court's already decided in Jelani that someone driving a car, that there wouldn't be a bar of parental immunity. So I believe that that particular fact of Sneed, that this court might reach that same conclusion. What I am saying is that there's some loose language in Sneed that I have a problem with about death, destroying the entire family. But if you look very carefully at what Justice Kadena is saying, and he repeats about three times that this is confined, that this case is confined to these facts, he keeps pointing out that this little child is the last survivor of his family. And so I believe that the respondent's reliance on Sneed is misplaced because this is a situation where the entire family is destroyed. We don't have that before this court. We don't have a situation where there's a last surviving person of the family. I see that my time has expired.
You may have a one-sentence statement of your third without argument, just so we can complete our outline.
Thank you, Your Honor. I believe that the issue which was decided before the Court of Appeals, I believe that what the Court of Appeals has done is abolish parental immunity for the reason that on the facts of negligent supervision, it has allowed a third party to recover against the parent. And for that reason, I certainly hope that this court will reverse the Court of Appeals opinion and reinstate the judgment of the trial court.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the third cause. All the foregoing arguments are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. The marshal will now please adjourn the court.
The audience will please rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned, subject to call.